Tonight on Arena, celebrating Eddie Van Halen and his guitar, and Jaime Martín of the RT National Symphony Orchestra on Music in a Time of Pandemic. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Fans of rock music worldwide were greeted with the very sad news yesterday when it emerged that guitar legend Eddie Van Halen had lost his battle with throat cancer and died at the age of 65. He was the leader of the rock band to which he gave his name, Van Halen. The band's first album was released in 1978, and by the mid-1980s they were one of the biggest bands of the era, providing a defining sound for the emerging MTV. As a guitarist, Eddie Van Halen was so technically gifted as to be almost peerless. And in a moment, we'll be talking to a true fan, fellow guitarist Ray Harmon, about just how good Van Halen was, Eddie Van Halen was, and the legacy that he leaves. But first of all, let's go right back to the first album and take a listen to Eddie Van Halen's virtuosity. This is track 2 on the album. And just think of how mesmerised music fans you must have been at the time. This track is, appropriately enough, it's called Eruption. What an extraordinary sound that is, even now in 2020. But let's go back to 1978 and think about how unusual it was. Guitarist and composer Ray Harmon is with me now to look back at the legacy of Eddie Van Halen, whose guitar playing we just heard there in that track, Eruption. When you think, Ray, of 1978, we're talking punk in the village with New York, with Blondie. We think disco or Bruce Springsteen, maybe metal music. It was kind of in a transition phase at the time. Where did Eddie Van Halen and that style of guitar playing that we just heard, where did he fit into that, all of that, or did he fit in?
I still listen to that. Even now, I still listen to it with my jaw open and wiping drool off the floor. It's incredible. It wasn't in a period of transition, but I always think about that in the sense that great bands, they always know they're great, you know, and Van Halen at that stage, they were well aware that they had this prodigy in the corner who was capable of incredible things. And even though disco and punk were going on at the same time, they were the sort of band who just toured and toured relentlessly, and they built up this, built up these really strong crowds, and they would play 5,000-seater, before they even had record deals, they'd be playing 5,000-seater venues in their hometown. They just knew they were good. Mm. They just played on through.
Yeah, and Eddie started the band with his brother Alex, who was the drummer. And then I suppose in the mid-70s, you got the lineup that was there for quite a while. David Lee Roth on vocals, Michael Anthony on bass, and then Sammy Hagen would come along a little bit later on. Eddie started actually in the world of classical music. There was a classical music background in his family. And I think it was Stuart Clark or maybe Gavin Jennings in Morning Ireland this morning were talking about, you know, it went from Mozart and Bach, but the minute he heard Jimmy Page, everything changed.
Yeah. Fascinating thing about them is the two brothers, Alex and Eddie, were born and moved to the States at the age of 7 and had no English and moved into a school in Pasadena. And they apparently 3 years in a row, they won this particular piano competition between Alex and Eddie. And their father was a professional musician, right? Yeah, but then originally Eddie started playing drums and Alex was playing guitar, and they switched instruments.
The mind boggles at that. Was he 7 or 8 when they moved to America? And did he? I don't think he had a word of English when he arrived. Did he?
No, they had no English. They had no English, and they were fairly destitute as well. Apparently, the family would supplement their father's income by playing gigs, weekends, and so on. So they learned their chops by actually playing with their father. They formed their first bands in high school, two brothers, and it was a very memorable name of a band. I'm trying to remember it now. It was called the Trojan Rubber Company, I think, was one of their first bands, and then before they formed Mammoth, and then went on to form Van Halen with Dave Lee Roth.
How important was, you know, I mentioned in my introduction the fact that they were kind of, and Poster Boys is too strong a word, but they were certainly, they grew as MTV grew. How important was that, the time that Van Halen came to fruition and the arrival of MTV? How did they feed into each other?
It was pretty symbiotic, as it was for a lot of bands at that time, like Dire Straits and The Police and countless other bands. They did it really well, though. You know, they absolutely embraced it, and they made so amazing, amazing videos. Very entertaining. I mean, Hot for Teacher is still a jaw dropper. You know.
Yes,
they were great at it.
They knew how to shock slightly. Although they were kind of, well, certainly Eddie was very much thought of as the clean living, happy smiling. Not really the rock. He didn't really have that kind of mad rock star personality, or outwardly, at any rate.
No, I believe he was the sort of the techno nerd in the band, and just loved making music. And it's interesting, you know, he's virtuosic, but I actually think one of his often overlooked incredible talents is his rhythmic and melodic ability. He had this, even though he was just, you know, dazzling with this, with the technical stuff he could do. Yeah. He could come up with these amazing earworms that people will still be playing and singing and trying to play in music shops for 50 years from now. You know, he had a really unusual melodic ability. He wrote great hooks.
Yeah, and I suppose he had a good starting point in his collaboration with Michael Jackson. How did the beat, it fits in with the MTV era in some ways, because there was a lot of criticism early on with MTV about diversity and the absence of black music in what they were doing on their videos. How did the collaboration with Michael Jackson on Beat It then, where Eddie Van Halen plays the guitar solo, how did that come about?
I believe that came about as a request from Quincy Jones, which I think originally Eddie Van Halen thought it was a prank, so he didn't realize. So he went along, and the guitar player from Toto was involved in the whole thing as well. So he went along, and he did it as a favor, apparently. And also, when he was there, when Michael Jackson went out of the room to do something else, he asked him to change the arrangement so that he could play in such a way, you know, the arrangement would suit his playing. It's incredible. He did it for free. He didn't think anybody would hear of it. The irony is that apparently Thriller kept 1984, the Van Halen album, off the number one spot.
Wow, yeah, there is an irony in that for sure. And the fact that he played this solo, which you're about to hear in Beat It, he played it and got paid nothing. There we go, Eddie Van Halen and the guitar solo from the Michael Jackson song Beat It, and Ray Harmon speaking to me about Eddie Van Halen tonight after the announcement of his death at the age of 65. We hear the brilliance of the playing there, absolutely, Ray, and I know you guitar players now love to noodle and love to get caught up in techniques and all the rest of it, but could, for the layman, could you tell us, in terms of technicalities, what was it that Eddie Van Halen did that people weren't doing previous to that? People talk about the tapping technique, but it wasn't so much that he invented that, it was what he did with it. Tapping being using your left hand to hit the neck of the guitar rather than strumming or using a plectrum down in the body or at the bridge of the guitar.
Yeah, it's almost like he wanted to play the guitar like a piano in that sense. He wanted to use the fretboard more. So it is a really difficult thing to do. It's incredibly difficult to do. There were loads of people doing it already. I mean, Paganini was doing it on violins and guitars. And I think, like, even just in the 60s and 70s, there were a lot more bands doing it, like Canned Heat. And he would have seen those playing in L.A. and the Whiskey and so on. So he would have been aware of the technique. He would have been practicing it at home. But he just somehow consolidated it into this amazing, powerful band that where so many things came together, the great tunes, the brilliant front man, and these incredible, simple riffs, you know. And it's surprisingly a lot of Van Halen songs, most of them, apart from the solos, are actually fairly simple to play, you know, for a lot of guitarists. So tapping was one thing. He had this incredible, he had this unusual technique where he held his plectrum between his thumb and his middle finger as opposed to his first finger, so that he left his first finger to tap. He also had an incredibly fast tremolo with his right hand, which is another thing. He also had like other things that he did with amplifiers and pickups. He was one of the first people to dip his pickups in wax to stop feedback and so on. And he even owned some patents for guitar hardware.
Yeah, so there was all that technical, as you said, the noodling side of things that he liked as well. How will you remember him, Ray? What is it that you will miss most and that you think about most on the time of his death?
I really loved the first one particularly. Puts me in good humour when I'm driving and I put it on. From watching interviews with him, he seemed like the loveliest, most down-to-earth man. So, rock and peace, Eddie.
Yeah, rock and peace, Eddie. Nicely put. That's Ray Harmon speaking to us about Eddie Van Halen on Arena this evening. And 1984, Thriller may have kept it off the top spot. It did okay, though. I think a couple of million. Is that what we were talking about in terms of sales? 10 million in terms of sales just being said into my ear. 10 million. So they did okay, even without taking Thriller off the top spot. So let's go to that era-defining album, 1984, and a song that you'll recognise the minute you hear the first chord. And you know what? That's Eddie Van Halen on keyboard there as well. He played the keyboard and guitar in that song Jump from 1984. And Ray Harmon was with us earlier on, remembering Eddie Van Halen, who died at the age of 65. Real treat in store for lovers of classical music this Friday, and indeed for the following two Fridays. RTE National Symphony Orchestra Live is a series of three concerts under the baton of principal conductor Jaime Martín, which will be streamed worldwide in HD from the National Concert Hall and broadcast live on RTE Lyric FM. I'm absolutely delighted to be joined live in studio by the principal conductor of the RTE National Symphony Orchestra, Jaime Martín. Because I really thought, Jaime, we'll be talking down the line. Now, we had a picture taken outside where we had to have our masks on and we were distant from each other. But this is a crazy time, particularly in the world of the arts, even more particularly in the world of orchestral playing, where people have to be sitting beside each other and close to each other. How difficult a time has it been for you the last few months?
Well, it has been incredibly hard for everybody, including you probably, but I think it has been particularly hard for musicians once life was starting to pick up things in June, July, started to move on. People could start going to restaurants, people start going out or taking trains, taking airplanes, and then music, theater, anything to do with stage, we realized that actually this is going to be very, very, very hard. So we all had to work very hard to find ways of how to put many people together on the stage in a safe way. I think safety is the most important thing.
Yeah, of course.
I think that we can try to do it, but if we have problems, then this will be the end. But I think the RTE National Symphony Orchestra, they've done a fantastic job in trying to be creative and trying to look into the future and trying to see that we have to move on in a way that they have put. Finally, now we are being able to work with the orchestra on the stage.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go into the concert hall, it's incredible. I mean, we have to take the temperature and usually, you know, the orchestra goes on the stage all together, but now they say, okay, first violins, please go on the stage.
Yeah.
This is for a rehearsal. Eh?
Yeah.
Now, second violins, please go on the stage. Now, the winds, so there are screens to protect people from the wind players. So I think everybody feels very safe, but this was a very important step to put people together on the stage.
And did it affect, you know, the fact that, because you have a smaller orchestra now than you would normally have, did that affect how you went about these concerts, you know, or were they weren't programmed in advance because you didn't know there was going to be this type of concert. Did the type, the repertoire that you chose for the three concerts, was it affected by the size of orchestra you could have?
Of course, because now we are with a smaller orchestra.
Yeah.
Basically, we are now probably half the orchestra. But, of course, the repertoire, we cannot use pieces with lots of percussion, for instance, or lots of brass players. But, for instance, this week we are doing Beethoven Symphony No. 7, which is exactly we are playing as it was written. We are doing it with a bit fewer strings than we would normally use. But in a way, this is good because it's the way it was written for.
Closer to what Beethoven.
So we are doing this week Beethoven Symphony No. 7 and Ravel Tombeau de Couperin, both incredibly different pieces of music. You know, we have the power and the sadness of Beethoven 7 and then the subtle and mellow melodies of Ravel. So
let's start with, I suppose, the power and the sadness of Beethoven 7, because I know this is a piece that goes right back to your childhood, in fact, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I think goes back to most childhoods of anybody that loves music. And which movement are you going to play
now? I'm going
to
play the second movement.
The second movement. Yeah. Well, the second movement, you know, because when this piece was premiered with Beethoven conducting in 1813, you know, this was for a benefit concert for the dead soldiers.
Yeah,
of the Battle of Hanau, and then this movement is an allegretto, which is a bit like a little dance, but it's a dance written in a march funèbre.
Yeah, it's like a funeral march.
It's like
really
a funeral
it.
March, and it was so popular that in the premiere, this movement had to be performed again.
And it was for these who were considered heroes at the time. And
absolutely.
I mean, and when you think of the people who are on a different type of front line now, there's a kind of a suitability in that as well. And a sadness, but yet a little sense of hope, I think it's safe to say, within this second movement of Beethoven Symphony No. 7. You'll recognise it when you hear it. The opening section there of the second movement of Beethoven Symphony No. 7, and that's a recording featuring the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, but it's the RTE National Symphony Orchestra who will be playing it on Friday night in the National Concert Hall, all of it being live streamed on RTE Culture, rte.ie/culture, the website, and broadcast live on RTE Lyric FM. Jaime Martín, Principal Conductor of the RTE NSO, with me in studio this evening. We were listening to it there. Yes, there's a sadness because we're in the minor key, but somehow in there is a little bit of hope. And later into that movement, it does slip into a major key and there's a brightness that appears. So hope is ever present, Jaime.
It is the kind of, the thing is that this, you know, is you have this funeral march, as you say, but at the same time with the rhythm, rum, pam, pam, pam. It's like a slow dance almost, you know, that's why it is marked allegretto.
Yeah.
I mean, a funeral march marked allegretto. You know, usually you would imagine, oh, it would be
grave,
adagio, lamentabile, or I don't know, whatever you want to say, or lento, funebre, but
or largo. You'd expect it to be very slow.
It's an allegretto, so it is a kind of celebration.
Yeah, it's kind of light and a little bit fast. Would that be a fair transition for allegretto?
But you know, is this, in a way, that's what I wanted with this concert. You know, to find a music that could celebrate a re-encounter. That's how I see it. I mean, for me to be back in Dublin and to meet this morning for the first time my colleagues of the orchestra, I think it is amazing. I mean, it is a very emotional thing because it is almost like saying, look, here we are. And we are going to look for the future together, you know? I mean, let's see. We don't know. We might have to stop maybe next month. We don't know what's going to happen for all of us.
Yeah.
But being
I'm interested though in that emotional idea, because I'm sure this has happened in lots of workplaces, not just with orchestras, but where people who haven't seen each other for, you know, months on end, who see each other very regularly in their workplace, that moment when a group of you get back together, there is quite a strong tug on the heart when that happens.
Of course it is strong. I mean, you know, even talking about that, I feel a bit emotional about it. But you know, I mean, usually to re-encounter people is always wonderful, and of course it could be emotional or happy or joyful, but at this time it is, because we don't know. You know, we are playing together. I am working now today with the orchestra, and who knows what is going to happen next week or in 2 weeks' time. So it gives you this time that we never better say that let's play like if today was
the last time.
Because, but I am not saying that because any of us is going to be terribly sick. It's just because rules might change.
Yes.
And then we might not be able to do this for some time. But what I am very happy is the management of the orchestra have done an amazing job in providing a very secure environment for everybody. And this is the only way,
as you said,
we can encourage the audience. I mean, if we succeed in doing this, then slowly when things get better, then we will be allowed maybe to have 100 people in the audience. And in few months, maybe we have 500.
We'll have to wait and see how that all pans out. The piece that the Beethoven 7 will be, the body of the concert, really. But you're introducing the concert with Ravel's Le Tombeau de Couperin. A very modern look back to a much older composer, Ravel. Very interesting what he does here.
Well, the thing is that Tombeau de Couperin, what he did is, Tombeau means in memoriam. So basically, this is each of the movements of this piece was dedicated thinking of one of Ravel's friends that died in the First World War. So, in theory, it's a very sad piece. Mm. But actually, it's not, because he did that in a form of a Baroque suite. So, on a suite which is a dance. It's a minuet, a rigodon.
Which is why Couperin is mentioned in here as a French composer of the Baroque era.
The reason I wanted to put this piece together with Beethoven is that, for me, it still has the sort of the theme of a dance, but treated in such a different way. With Ravel is the power, sometimes is the you are in awe of this kind of music, like this Beethoven Symphony number 7 is like a cathedral. And then suddenly in Tombeau de Couperin is the most beautiful sounds. It's like soothing sounds.
The other thing we've got to remember is Couperin would have written these pieces, or would have been writing for harpsichord at the time. Ravel writing for piano, but this is an orchestration of that piano verse. So let's have a listen to it, because it's the colours that you get here that are quite extraordinary. It's just so beautiful, Le Tombeau de Couperin there, the Ravel composition played by the Frankfurt Radio Symphony Orchestra there, conducted by Jaime Martín, who is sitting in front of me and will be conducting the same piece with the RTE National Symphony Orchestra on Friday night. And you recognise that all of a sudden. I could see your ears pricking up going, who's playing there?
Well, the thing is that I know that Assumpta from the orchestra also asked me, do you have any recordings? And I said, well, there is this thing on YouTube, but I was not sure if you used it.
Yeah, we found it. Yeah.
that's very good. I did recognize a little bit of that, but I love this piece so much. Because it's, you know, as you said, this is an orchestration of a piano piece, and this is what Ravel can do.
He's a master orchestrator.
It's like, look at Bolero. And the same tune goes for 15 minutes, and what Ravel does to it is each time is done with a different instrument. And for me, Ravel is the closest to a painter. I mean, just it's like puts dashes of color on a canvas and then combines instruments in a way that is so inspiring.
Yeah, Yeah, no, there's no doubt that he I think you've referred to him, or you refer to this piece almost, he's like a painter in this, really, isn't he?
He's like a painting. And at the same time, then it requires amazing individual efforts from musicians mm-hmm. in the orchestra. For instance, this movement is one of the most famous oboe solos in the literature. So every audition for any orchestra in the world, you have to play this piece. So yeah. It's one of those pieces for oboe players. It's a very important piece. And but there are so many solos by instruments. And yeah. I thought, since we are talking about celebration and re-encountering each other, I wanted to show how all this orchestra, basically, there are so fantastic soloists, people in the orchestra that yeah. have their own voice. And I think it's fantastic that this piece allows them to be heard.
Yeah, well, that's for sure. And people can hear it Friday night. So you have this, you have the one on Friday, you have two more coming up after that, interesting programs there as well. Stravinsky, Mozart and Prokofiev on the 16th. And then the following week, Faya. Oh, you're going very Spanish.
We do a Spanish program. We are going to do...
And Manuel de Falla again. And Chappie, the prelude from La Revoltosa. So lots of Spanish flavour from then on. Jaime, great to see you.
Very nice to see you too.
And hope that the music is bringing you lots of solace. Must do so, because it will do on Friday night. I know I listened to last Friday's concert on Sunday evening. I got to listen to it and mm-hmm. Online. Just I went to the website, and it's such a lovely thing to do.
Yeah.
So I'll be doing the same thing this week. Won't be able to be with you at 7. I'll be somewhere else, like here. So let us finish up with a little section from certainly the Beethoven 7, Symphony number 7, and the one that really lifts the heart, the third movement. Presto. Nothing slow about this one. A little flavour of the third movement there, the Presto movement from Beethoven's Symphony No. 7, one of the pieces that you can hear this Friday with Jaime Martín and the RTÉ National Symphony Orchestra live, the Beethoven No. 7 alongside Ravel's Le Tombeau de Couperin, and that will take place at the National Concert Hall, 7 p.m. You can watch the concert live on RTÉ Culture, rte.ie/culture. You can listen live on RTÉ Lyric FM, or you can do what I did. You can go back and listen to it on Sunday on the RTÉ player, but you can find out full details of everything that's happening there on rte.ie/NSO. The Portuguese artist Paula Rego is a master of narrative painting. Her use of fairy tales, literature and folklore invest her often political and personal paintings with layers of symbolism and magic realism. The Irish Museum of Modern Art is currently hosting an exhibition of Rego's work called Obedience and Defiance. It will reopen once we're out of level 3 of the current restrictions. In the meantime, I'm delighted to be joined by the curator of the Paula Rego Show, Catherine Lampert, to introduce us to the painter and whet our appetites for this exhibition. Is it fair to say, really, some of Rego's work is instantly recognisable? I suppose if we think of Angel from 1998, a woman with a sword in one hand and kind of, are they sea sponges that she's holding in the other? But I think it's an image that a lot of people would recognise quite quickly.
That's right. It's called Angel, and she added this to the story of the crime of Father Amaro, about a young priest seducing one of the people in his parish, and she gets pregnant, and then she's deserted, and so Paula has Angel. She's holding the sword and the sponge, and she's taking revenge on behalf of Amelia,
but even the fact that we're talking about a series of paintings there that tells the story of this particular priest's exploits, mostly bad. Let's be honest about it. She really does. She loved Rego. She loves to tell a story in her paintings. She is a storyteller in oil, I suppose.
Yes and no. I mean, she says that she often takes inspiration from a story, especially one that resonates with something that she's gone through. And then she when she says, it's like entering a long, dark tunnel. She doesn't really know how it's going to come out. She knows who she's going to draw from, these are the pictures of the 90s and beyond. She might add furniture and sort of props, but she doesn't really know the twist to it until she's making the work. It's not all planned in advance or taken from a script from anybody else.
Yeah, she's not going chapter one, chapter two, chapter three. She's not working in that way of working at all. The exhibition, which is currently hanging in the Irish Museum of Modern Art, open to the public when the gallery reopens. It spans the artist's career from 1960 through until the present day. Is there a particular emphasis in the pictures and the work that you've chosen and curated for this exhibition?
Well, it's about, particularly about what you could call political, if you call it in the sense of social and sexual and power structures. So it begins with the work from the 1960s, which she did very much about Salazar's regime. She grew up in a family that was very Republican, anti-monarchy, anti-clerical, and with the repression that these fascist regime in sort of collaboration with the church exerted over her country. And she was born in 1935, so exerted over in the 30s and the 40s and up until the 70s. So these pictures are collage-based, but they have wonderful titles like Manifesto for a Lost Cause and The Exile and Salazar, Bombardine, The Homeland. And they're very bold. When she showed them in Lisbon, she could easily have been, they could have been all, the exhibition closed down, and she could have been, arrested, in trouble, exactly. But somehow the knowing people caught the references, and then others, just caught the sense of menace and revenge and excitement and all sorts of layers. So the work is very layered. It's terrific. Nobody would just give it one explanation each picture. You keep discovering things, and she wants people to interpret them in their own way too. Many of the themes are so prescient; they're absolutely terrific. When we started out with this exhibition, we knew of certain ones like war and abortion and so forth. But she has pictures about depression, about what that did to her father. There's a spectacular triptych at the end, which I don't want to spoil. I'm so eager for people to get to the exhibition that I don't even want to say what's a great picture that finishes it, because it looks just amazing. It's all by itself in one of the galleries.
Well, I won't ask you to tell me what finishes the exhibition, but I will ask you to tell me about some of the others then. You mentioned her father there. That relationship with her father is very important. The Pillow Man. Just explain how the play The Pillow Man fed into the piece that we see in the exhibition. And was it her father that actually modelled for the male figure in that particular painting?
No. It was made after he had died, which was in the 60s. But she had seen the premiere performance of Martin McDonagh's play, The Pillow Man, at the National Theatre in London, and was sort of really taken with it. And they began exchanging ideas and meeting. And so that's the story behind it. A little girl who wants to be Jesus, and another little girl who puts razors into apples. But she actually puts it in, the setting is in Estoril, a sort of beach city which she spent a lot of her youth in, and during the Second World War. So they're sort of the ambiance of Allied and Nazi spies mixing and then she, what's wonderful to me is that she puts her sort of feelings of, longing and regret that her father didn't have, because of the times, he didn't fulfill a lot of his own ambitions. He had a factory, electrical engineer, but he wanted to write, he wanted to travel, things he couldn't really do in that period. And he suffered from very serious depression. So he's this big stuffed figure, a sort of black stocking. And she's a young girl consoling him. So it has many layers. It's great fiction.
Yeah, I suppose rather than the father being the model, he might have been somewhere in the back of her mind in terms of this painting. Maybe that's a much better way of putting it. There's another image there are several that I came across in the catalogue that kind of stopped me in my tracks. But there's one that you have to look at, I had to look at several times, The Family from 1988. Just describe, how would you describe what's happening in that particular picture?
Well, that's in fact, that picture isn't in the exhibition, but the one very similar called The Maids is. It is a sort of her. It's one of the themes is the feelings people have as some member of the family suffering from a sort of terminal illness, which is true of her husband, the artist Dick Willing, had multiple sclerosis and was getting weaker and weaker and more frustrated. So the family is sort of, on one hand, kind of trying to revive him, but as you say, the young girl sort of pressing against him, and it's full of unresolved difficult things to explain, and yet it's great composition, you know, with the picture in the front and a sort of little toy theater at the back, things that Vic himself remembered from his childhood. And then the picture we have that's so great is called The Maids, and that's two maids approaching their employer and the employer's daughter, and it has, again, there's quite a lot of menace in this picture, but it's a very large picture, and it was first shown when she had her first exhibition in 1988 in a public venue in Britain.
Her father encouraged her, in fact, to go to London to study art and to become...
That's absolutely right. He thought that it would be very difficult for a woman to really get anywhere as an artist in Portugal, and so he had her go and first to a year of sort of end of secondary school, and then she went into the Slade in 1952. And for a long time, she didn't, do things she learned at the Slade, like draw from the model. But she was actually well treated at the Slade by William Coldstream, and Ellis Lowry was very keen on her work. And then when she turned to using a model in the early 90s, it sort of all came to her. She's a fantastic draftsman, and you can see that both in the drawings in the show, but also in the compositions for this series called Dog Women.
Yeah, the dog is a very important image. It recurs in several of the paintings that we get in the exhibition. Can you explain a little bit how she uses that, or how that figure or the metaphor, the idea of the dog develops over the period that you cover in the exhibition?
Well, on one hand, she remembers farm dogs and wild dogs, and she did do a drawing in 1952 with a kind of snarling dog on all fours. But when she was missing her husband, who by this time was dead in the early 90s, and so she used a woman who sort of acts like an animal. She, on one hand, she's quite dependent. In one picture, she's lying on what is probably the master's coat, and sort of mourning him, but she's also resisting, and she's has animal qualities as well as female qualities. And these pictures, there's one called Bad Dogs, one called Lush, Sleeper. They're, you can't give them one interpretation. They have all sorts of nuances.
Yeah, and they really fit in with the exhibition title of Obedience and Defiance. You know, it fits in with that idea.
And she never sees women as victims, even in some of the toughest pictures, or the one with the arranged marriage a la mode. She sees women who also have, it's a tense and exciting relationship with people around them, their family and their lovers and so forth. They're never meant to be victims, even the one, two women being stoned, which is pretty tough.
Yeah, that's
as well.
Yeah, another, and they are, some of them, there's quite a brutal aspect to many of the pictures, not only in the themes of the pictures themselves, but almost in the style of it. There's a kind of a harsh quality. Harsh isn't, I'm not getting the right word, brutal is the best word that I can come up with it. Can you describe that style of painting that she has in many of the pieces?
Well, she very unusually, she was working up until about 10 years ago in pastel, and then pastel on paper laid on aluminium, and she really had to work hard to sort of get the tonality and to get the... She's very good on details like the clothes people wear and the soles of the feet being all sort of brown and, like real life. They're never glamorized. But from up close, you see this, how physical the act of actually working is. And she says that she feels like a man when she's doing that. She has to be aggressive. She has to stand on her feet. She has to, really work her materials into the surfaces. So she doesn't try to make them shocking in the sense of bloody or, violent in other ways. the violence is sort of undertones, not specific details or dramas.
Yes, yeah. No, I think you said you used the word physical there, but that would be the way. That's a good way to, or muscular. They have that quality to them. A lot
yes,
of the pain,
they do.
Despite the fact that they're pastels, which is quite astonishing. Just finally, then she covered the poly, we should mention. You mentioned her husband there. Victor Willing was her. Victor is his first name, isn't it? Willing, her husband, who was her tutor, in fact, in Slade, was he?
No, he wasn't a tutor. He was older than she was, but he was a sort of mature student who'd come to the Slade sort of earlier, a couple of years earlier than she did. And she was very close to quite a lot of the artists, who particularly male artists like Michael Andrews and Ewan Uglow. And so although we don't associate her with some of those kind of School of London artists, and she wasn't included in the original exhibition, she's now, her reputation is really growing quickly in the last 5 years, and I think this exhibition has done a lot for it, because it's bold, it deliberately goes away from the drawings from Jane Eyre and Peter Pan, etc. It's not that those aren't good, but this exhibition is more challenging, perhaps, and also has some great large works which look fantastic at East Wing of Emma.
And a brilliant triptych in the final room that you're not telling us about, or at least you don't want to give away.
I don't want to,
you don't want to give
it.
Away the ending.
No. Well, there are great works all the way through.
Absolutely. Well, listen, Catherine, thanks so much for speaking to us this evening, and let's hope that we can get back to a situation very soon where the public can actually visit IMA, the Irish Museum of Modern Art. Paula Rigo, Obedience and Defiance, curated by Catherine Lampert, who was speaking to me this evening, will be at IMA as soon as our current restrictions lift, and you can find out full information on imma.ie. Illuminations is a brand new online gallery specially commissioned by RTE to showcase the work of artists including Isabel Nolan, Nidhi Thack and Enda Walsh. It launches today, and I'm delighted to say I'm joined on the line by two of the artists involved, Hazel Cunha, photographer and visual artist, and Megan K. Fox, writer and director in TV and film. Have to come to you first, Megan, on the title, Love in a Time of Coronavirus. Every time I looked at that today, I kept saying, Love in a Time of Cholera. Where have I heard that before? But clearly, you read the book, and this was the idea that started to feed into your short film for Illuminations.
No, I won't claim to have read the book, Love in the Time of Cholera. I was just aware of the title and thought, Love in the Time of Corona. Oh, that's very, it turned out to be very unoriginal, and I'd say there will probably be about 50 films called Love in the Time of Corona next year.
Right, yours is the first one that we're getting to talk about, and it's the first one the first one that I've come across at any rate.
Well, hopefully being first out the gate counts for something.
Yeah, so look, why did we play a clip from, because is this you that we find in this situation, or is this a character that we're finding in this situation?
It's certainly somewhat autobiographical, but I do not play the character. It is a fictionalized character.
Right. So 23-year-old Grania is the person who's speaking to us here. And she's missing certain things because of lockdown.
But I miss touch, hugs, first kisses, first times, warm skin. I've tried to adapt to the whole socially distanced dating thing, but it's just not really the same.
So you've cut your hair since taking the photos?
Mm-hmm.
And the beard as well?
Yeah.
So can I see your face?
I'd rather not take off the mask.
Right. Of course.
There you go. I should have explained before that Grania, the character, is out on a Tinder date when the chap in question, played by Phelan O'Neill there. Would you say he's taken the rules to an extreme there, or do you think he's kind of right, or do you have an opinion on that, Megan?
I think he is taking the rules to the extreme a bit, but we're working with comedy, so we can have a bit of poetic license there to imagine that she might have snagged herself somebody that's kind of on the same spectrum of being as odd as she is, so it's believable that this guy could be a bit eccentric.
A bit odd too. Yeah. Let me go to Hazel then at this point. Hazel Cunha, Now, you have had the joy of having the Phoenix Park right beside you, particularly during the early stages of lockdown, Hazel, when we could only go 2 kilometres away from our homes. You had the Phoenix Park to play around in.
Yeah, that's right. I'm really, really lucky to live close by. So even in, as you say, the height of the lockdown, when the restrictions were quite harsh, I could still, you know, legally go at least to the Phoenix Park and get away from things a little bit. So very lucky.
And how did that feed in then to the piece that you have done for Illuminations?
Well, basically the series of images that I've done, they're mixed media pieces combining photographic portraits with embroidery. So embroidery is kind of a new hobby that I'd picked up just before the start of the lockdown. And also just going to the Phoenix Park, I sort of brought them together by featuring portraits mixed in with natural features of embroidery around them. So that's sort of my ode to the Phoenix Park and to the natural world.
Yeah, and what struck me is that I'd really love to see them in reality, because as I was looking at them on screen today, and then I saw you in a short video kind of showing us how you make them. It's things like flowers, it's things like feathers that are embroidered effectively onto these photographs or these drawings or photographs that you have underneath, figures, faces for the most part. It really struck me that natural world seemed to be bringing a sense of colour and a sense of hope into the portraits.
Yeah, absolutely. I really tried to leave all the colour to the embroidery elements. So the photographic portraits that I was embroidering on top of are all monochrome. Because the colour in this context really represents the sort of joy and the vitality, the sense of peace that I've gotten from taking time out in the Phoenix Park.
What about in general for you, Megan? I mean, the world of television, yes, things can actually, in television and film, things can be done possibly in a way that they can't be done in theatre. How has lockdown been? How have you worked through in terms of putting work out there or making work for yourself?
Well, it's been very different, obviously. I direct on Fair City as well as making my short films. I was kind of in the middle of a block of Fair City when the lockdown initially happened. So obviously that was just cut off straight away. So that was quite difficult. You know, it just plunged everybody who was working in that industry straight into, you know, just doing nothing for months on end and not knowing when things would pick up again, you know, as it is for a lot of people at the moment. But then, you know, to get the opportunity for Illuminations, you know, what I had initially thought was I'll use this time to focus on trying to write my feature film. But as a lot of people, I'm sure, found, you know, we went into it thinking, planning these great things that we would do, and then just the day-to-day stress and anxiety of the moment makes it quite hard to concentrate on a big project like that. So to have had the opportunity to make a short, and to make a short that was a bit of fun as well, and, you know, kind of just exploring some of the more everyday humorous moments of dealing with this was really cathartic. And we definitely had to do things differently than usual. You know, we had to minimize the cast, the crew, the locations, the you know, the actors that play the couple in the film are my sister and her girlfriend, who are my actual housemates.
So you could the three of you could be in the one room and you didn't have to worry about distancing in that case.
Exactly. So what it ended up being was, you know, such a skeleton crew. It was literally our DOP, Evan Barry, and our sound guy, Simon Murphy, and then Fiona Bergen, who plays our lead. They were the only three outsiders coming into our household.
Right.
So, and, you know, it's just about thinking about minimising.
Yeah, to think about those things in a way you wouldn't normally have to do that. I think I'm interested, Hazel, that in fact the embroidery had started before lockdown, but it seems as if it really has inspired you in new ways during that period. Did you find that new skill allowed you to think in a new way?
Yeah, absolutely. As you mentioned there, I did a tiny bit of it before lockdown, but nothing that involved the amount of time that was needed for it. So given that work had become pretty irregular, if not non-existent, and it was a big negative, it really opened up a lot of time to use up. So getting involved in something that really takes a lot of concentration and something that, you know, you can get wrapped up in and spend hours on was something that came in very handy over the last few months. It was something that was very therapeutic.
Yeah,
and it sort of just came out naturally, so it was great.
Yeah, and certainly the embroidery in the images I saw works really well within those portraits as well. That's Hazel Cunha and Megan K. Fox talking to us about their input into Illuminations, which is online from today, in fact, and it will be there until early December, and it'll build through the coming weeks, and we'll refer to some of the new pieces as they're put onto the website over the weeks here on the programme as well. But you can find out full details on rte.ie/illuminations. That is our lot for this evening's. Paula Shields and Liam Murphy were the researchers. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Gar Duffy was in sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Olin McGowan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.